everybody. It is Wednesday, December 14th, 2011, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm Ken. As always, you can drop us an email by writing to us at ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show. And, of course, go to the Facebook, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have, as always, a jam-packed show for you this week, so we got to get started. Hey, first guest, are you ready to go?
Yes, I am.
That's a good thing. Let me introduce you. And this is a long one, so you need to just sit back there for a second. Jerry Jewell is an actor, a comedian, an author. With her role as Cousin Jerry on the NBC sitcom The Facts of Life, she was the first person with a disability to have a regular role on a primetime series. She's appeared on such shows as The Great Space Coaster, the Emmy Award-winning movie Two of a Kind, Sesame Street, 21 Jump Street, Young and the Restless, and the HBO hit series Deadwood. She is a highly sought-after motivational speaker and trainer in the areas of disability and diversity. She's performed on all of the major comedy stages and just this year authored her autobiography, I'm Walking as Straight as I Can, which I enjoyed so immensely, and we're going to talk about that. She's been the recipient of so many awards, including the 1992 Founders Award, the 2005 Independent Living Legacy Award, the 2006 Victory Award, the 2011 Disability Awareness Award from the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, and was just recently named to our favorite list of all the lists, the Out 100 Most Influential Individuals on LGBT Culture in 2011. Jerry Jewell, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Oh, thank you, Ken.
How are things out there in California?
Actually, looking out my window, it's raining. I'm shocked.
Oh, well, that we're going to brighten things up. Can we brighten things up for your day?
Yeah, I think we should.
Let's do it. Well, first of all, we always start with the Out 100. What a great honor, the Out 100.
It really was. It was phenomenal.
How did you find out about it?
Well, they called me, they approached me, and congratulated me for making the 100 out, and told me what was involved, and asked me if it was okay. They always have to get your approval. In other words, if I had said, no, thank you, I appreciate the honor, but I don't want to be among them. And no, that wasn't my attitude.
No.
I was absolutely thrilled that I made.
We love that list. And the pictures, the photos this year were just phenomenal. Tell everybody about your photo, which was particularly intriguing.
Well, it's interesting because the photographer wanted all the Out 100s to replicate a photo of the past, a famous photo of a famous icon. And he chose who was who. We didn't choose who we were going to be. And he showed me the photo of Gloria Swanson.
Yeah.
A very famous photo of her when she was 32. And I have to tell you, I looked at the photo and I was like, oh. And I was like, is this my, I mean, do we get a choice here?
Is this a metaphor?
Yeah, I know. And he said, no. This is the one for you. The magic is all in the eyes. It's the eyes, Jerry. And I said, well, it would have to be the eyes.
Everything else. And so we should tell people, if they haven't seen it, this is an iconic photo of Gloria Swanson. Very, shall we say, veiled.
Yeah, let's say that. And I was thinking, how will anybody even know it's me?
Thankfully, your name was right there next to it.
I know. That's what I said. Okay, I'll do Gloria Swanson.
It was, well, I have to say, I mean, it was, I when I saw it, I said, I really thought, I will tell you, the first thing I thought was exactly what I said. This must be a metaphor. But it was really, it's quite the striking picture, Jerry.
It is so incredible. I mean, it turned out much better than I thought it would. Truthfully, when I saw it, oh my God, I look so much like my mother.
Mm.
Which is a compliment.
Yes. Was your mother often veiled?
Never.
But it's in the eyes.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's how she would look if she wore a mask.
And did you get to go to the party?
I did not. Okay. I was in L.A. at the time. I wanted to, but I was in New York.
Okay. Well, I heard it was fun, but that they missed you terribly.
Oh, you did not.
That's not the point of the story, Jerry. Okay, we have so much to talk about. Are you ready?
I am always ready.
Now, I have to tell you, I devoured I'm Walking as Straight as I Can. I devoured it. And I should say the postscript as well, Transcending Disability in Hollywood and Beyond. I tore through this, and I was left thinking, and I have so many questions about the book, but the first thing I was thinking after I finished that I would ask you, so I've devoured it, I've read it, I've underlined things, there are highlights, there are dog-eared pages. How well do I know you now after reading this?
You know me too well.
Because I feel like, oh my gosh, I know a lot of stuff. What is your comfort level knowing, okay, so these folks know all of these different things about me?
Well, you know, when I sat down to write the book, I'm a very spiritual individual.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I'm not religious, but I'm very, very spiritual. And it's very important to be aware of our intention.
Mm-hmm.
And all through the book, I felt my number one intention was to be honest, tell the truth. My second intention was not to hurt anybody at any expense. And my third intention was to let people know that there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
That if they get into, you know, where their life, where you feel like you can't go on, read my book and give it a second thought.
Absolutely.
And move forward.
And we should say it did not start out perhaps as an autobiography. Tell everyone about the remarkable journey of Jenny Jem.
Yes, I was going to write it as a fiction. That was my original idea for a number of reasons. But one of the reasons was because there were so many painful things in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't sure that I could write about it as a first person.
Right.
And when we approached the publishers, ECW Press, they weren't interested in Jenny Jem. They wanted Jerry Jewell.
They wanted Jerry Jewell.
Yes. So I wrote the truth as much as I could. As much as I was able to.
Can you talk a little bit about your writing process? Now, I know you worked with Ted Nicholson, who's worked with other authors. How do you set out to write? Did you have a routine? How did you get into that space to put pen to paper or fingers to keyboard?
Basically, Ted was a wonderful anchor for me.
Okay.
And I would write sometimes 8 to 16 hours a day.
Mm.
And then I would email it to him, and he would read it with remarks, with underlined, with questions, and mail it back and say things like, is this what you mean here?
Right.
Did you really want to write this? And so he kept me anchored. And the only way that I would write with Ted, as he really was more of a life coach and an editor. He did not write any of the book because I told him that if you're going to change my words and make it a book that's not mine, then I can't work with you.
Yeah.
And he kept that promise. All those words are my own.
I'm so much to talk about. Well, before one can even get into the text of the book, though, they have to read. They don't have to, but they should read the foreword by Patty Duke, who wrote a lovely setup to the book.
That just brings tears to my eyes every time I read it, because she didn't have to do that. And she did it in the 11th hour.
Wow.
There was a deadline. And she came through in the 11th hour. She said, oh, my God, of course I would write a foreword for your book. It will warm me forever.
Yeah, one of the experiences that you have with Patty Duke And I really, there's so many stories in the book, and I'm always kind of hesitant when I talk to someone who's written a book, because I don't want to give too much away, because we do want people to buy the book, Jerry.
Yes, we do.
But if you could talk a little bit, I mean, that's we like when people buy the book, and people need to buy this book. Your interactions with Patty Duke around the I Love Liberty TV special, it's almost surreal. First of all, there's a sentence that only I don't know how many people in the world ever can write the sentence with all honesty, quote, "I was running lines with Jane Fonda and Patty Duke just gleamed at the sight of it." I don't think there are a lot of people who else can say that with honesty. So let's put that out there. Can you tell people about your experience of doing I Love Liberty? Because it is an incredible story.
I Love Liberty was a special that was done by Norman Lear. He produced it in 1982. It was a celebrity jam-packed show. I was a newcomer. I was the only newbie in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And because there were so many celebrities, they had to have two celebrities per trailer, you know, for dressing rooms.
Yeah.
And the celebrity that I was chosen to share a trailer with wouldn't share a trailer with me. For whatever reason. Yeah, I will never know. And quite frankly, it might not have anything to do with me.
There you go.
So, but it was awkward because I was standing there and the PA was saying, you know, but she's assigned to this trailer. And Patty Duke, Anna, she goes by Anna now, was standing off the side and heard the dialogue. And she came over and rescued me. And she said, you know, Jane Fonda and I can have a third person in our trailer. And that was the beginning of my relationship with Patty Duke.
Unbelievable. And then can we go a little bit further with this? Because the unbelievable thing is what happened on stage with you as well. So you get out there to do your monologue.
And put 25,000 people.
Oh my gosh.
Went into a comedy routine and 25,000 people were not laughing. And I thought that my life was over. I thought, oh my God, I'm bombing. I can't believe this. They hate me. Norman Lear panicked and came running down from the control booth and came up on stage and held me in his arms. He thought that I was having a nervous breakdown.
Oh, my gosh.
But I looked at him and he said, Jerry, are you all right? He was so worried about me. And I just looked at him and said, Norman, I'm fine, but you know what? The material sucks. And he looked at me and smiled, and he said, sweetheart, your mic isn't on. It never was.
Oh, my God. And so the audience was just sitting there watching you, I would assume gesticulating, and some people could probably see you mouthing, but nothing, they couldn't hear anything.
Yeah, they were watching me doing pantomime.
It's Jerry Jewell's famous Marcel Marceau routine that she is piloting out for this Hollywood Bowl. And so then they turned your mic on, and did you get off the stage? No, you did not.
You know, Norman put his arms around me and turned around and faced the audience, and he asked the audience how many people want to give Jerry Jewell a second chance. And the whole room stood up and gave me a standing ovation.
Unbelievable.
I mean, it was amazing.
Unbelievable. And then you do your routine, you get another standing ovation, you walk off stage, and who's right there? Oscar winner Patty Duke.
Patty Duke.
Unbelievable. Oh, and it's so funny. I'm a very involved reader, Jerry, apparently, when I read that part of the book and Norman Lear asked the audience who wants to give Jerry a second chance. I think I actually said out loud, I do. But then I realized that no one could hear me because I was reading the book. But it was lovely. Unbelievable story. Okay. We have to talk about humor. One of the quotes from your book that I loved, and there's so many, you wrote, "One of my strongest traits since I was a child has always been my sense of humor. My creative mind and sense of humor are what carried me to rarely experienced highs and what heightened my ability to cope with shadowy lows as well. Where do you, Jerry Jewell, where do you find the funny? Where do you find the humor?
Well, I think I was born with it in part because I have always had that ability. Plus, my family had a sense of humor. So, you know, it is important. If I didn't have a sense of humor, I would have been a very bitter human being because, like a lot of kids with disabilities, and I didn't write everything. You can't put, 55 years and 200 and some odd pages.
Right.
But, you know, I was ridiculed a lot as a kid and made fun of and mimicked. And if I didn't have a sense of humor about myself, I don't know that I could have withstand that.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I want to be such an advocate for the bullying that goes on today.
Yeah.
It's got to stop. People don't realize how deeply it hurts people. It's senseless. And I will forever be an advocate against bullying because I was bullied not for being gay, but for having CP.
Right. And one of the things that you do well to highlight, it's not just fellow kids who are doing the bullying. There's an unbelievable story in the book about a neighbor who, an adult, where your brother had to actually intervene, and then your mother, and then your father. But it's not even just kids that are perpetuating the bullying, but in some instances, it's the adults, it's the people who are supposed to be the role models.
You know, to be honest with you, I think most bullying comes from the adults anyway.
Yeah.
Because I do not believe that any child is born with the ability to hate and be cruel or prejudice. And I think those are learned from whatever adults are around them.
Yeah, absolutely.
I really believe that. So the adults, it doesn't surprise me now looking back, that a neighbor of mine didn't want me to play with her kid because I had CP.
Yeah.
At the expense of, you know, just treating me wrong, just totally wrong.
And used her car to tell you that. Wasn't just words in this case. And I saw it.
Not only was she ignorant, she was stupid.
Yes. Oh, did I love your brother in that story. That was, I loved that piece. And you just spoke, did you not, at a benefit concert for the Trevor Project?
I did.
What was that experience like?
It was wonderful. I mean, it's such a great organization.
Yeah.
I would support the Trevor Project forever. Absolutely.
Fantastic. That's fantastic. Now, one of the things that floored me about reading through, I'm walking as straight as I can. Jerry Jewell, you have moved so many times. Every time, it was just like, well, she hasn't moved in a couple pages. I guess that's coming up soon. And indeed, a few pages later. Do you have a sense of how many times you have moved?
I believe it's up to 37 times.
Oh my gosh. You must be, I mean, I would assume you are one of the best packers that there ever, I would call you. If I need to move, I'm calling Jerry Jewell because I think you must have it down to a science.
Pretty much.
That's fantastic. It was one of the things that cracked me up. Well, I want to do another quote because this is, you write a lot about success. And one of the things that you write about success, you write, "By appearances, it always looked as though I was on top of everything. The hardships that I endured were never news, so the assumption was always that I was successful and doing great. What people forget is that success is not a tangible object, but something that is fluid and ever-changing. The face of success is constantly in motion." That was a lovely passage in the book.
Oh, thank you. And it spoke the truth. It is the truth. Success has nothing to do with how much money we have or what we've accomplished or whatever. It's, It's within our being and our movement in life. And that's what I believe success is. Because life is going to have ebb and flows like the ocean.
Right.
And because we have setbacks, it doesn't mean that we're not successful. It just means that we have setbacks and have to move forward again.
And there is that temptation for some people to give up. And you wrote, I have to tell you, my favorite line in the entire book, there was always a pilot light on my will to live.
Oh, yes.
There was always a pilot light on my will to live. What do you have to say to all of those folks who just, they just want to give up? Whether it's, you know, because we get these emails, we love getting emails from our listeners. The hardest ones to get are from often teenagers from somewhere in the middle of the country saying, I can't do it anymore. It's all just too much for me. The bullying, whatever it may be. What do you, Jerry Jewell, have to say in particular to those kids?
You know, I have been in the darkest of dark moments in my life where I thought I couldn't go on any farther. But that pilot light is something that is the essence of our spirit and our soul and what we believe about us. And no matter what anybody else believed about me, ultimately what's going to keep us alive and keep us going is what we believe about ourselves. So the most important thing in life is what you believe about you.
Yeah.
You know, as you can tell, my career is up and down over the years. And even after Deadwood, and Deadwood meaning Deadwood.
Right.
It got yanked from HBO.
Yeah.
And everybody thought, once again, my career is over.
Right.
I would not believe that. That is not within my thinking. That was not within my vision. And, yeah, okay, another setback, but it doesn't mean it's over until I say it's over.
No, and it's not over. There's more.
Well, I just got done filming an episode of a brand new series on Fox called Alcatraz.
Fantastic. Oh, that's, aren't there people from Lost on Alcatraz?
Yes. And it starts airing in January, and my character is introduced in the fifth episode. So I would say the most important thing to people who are struggling, don't buy into failure. There's no such thing as failure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Failure is, it doesn't even compute in my mind. There are only setbacks at which we can learn from and grow from, become a stronger person, believe it or not, become a more compassionate person. I think that I have been hurt deeply in my life, very deeply. And I know this is going to sound weird, but I am grateful for every person that hurt me, because never in a million years would I do that to someone else.
Yeah. Yeah.
It put in my consciousness how important it is to love.
Love that. And one of the things that, oh, I will say about Deadwood real quick, I was at the annual Schneck Hanukkah party this weekend, and my brother asked me, oh, who's on the show this week? I said, oh, Jerry Jewell. She was on The Facts of Life. She was on Deadwood. And he said, oh, they were not nice to her on Deadwood. I said, no, they were not.
That's just the character.
That was just Jewel. Well, one of the things that you've done quite well is surround yourself with some really great people. I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about one of your angels. Tell everybody about Gloria, because I finished this book and I was so grateful for Gloria.
Gloria is definitely an angel in my path. She is my younger sister. She has been there for me at every turn. We've had an incredible experience together. Gloria came into the world, and I don't remember if I wrote this in my book. I don't know if I did, because I had a problem with word count. So the editor's kind of like, well, you know, that's not totally necessary. But when Gloria was born, she was born 3 years younger than me. And I think Gloria came into the world knowing that she had a sister who was different, who was going to need more than, you know, she psychologically became the older sister, even though she was 3 years younger. And my mother told me that when Gloria was five and I was, no, Gloria was two and I was five. She said she saw us playing ball in the backyard, and Gloria would throw the ball to me, run over, pick it up, hand it to me, go back and let me throw it back because she knew I couldn't catch it.
Oh, my gosh. And then you know, it just went like that throughout your lives together. What, I mean, just an incredible source of support. I felt like I knew her.
She's a wonderful, I am so blessed to have Gloria as my sister, I can't tell you. Not to say that there are ups and downs
right.
in sibling relationships.
Right.
But you know what? In the end, she's always been there for me.
Oh, that's great. I wanted to hear you talk about Gloria. It was so great reading about her. So I thank you for telling us more about her.
Thank you for asking about her. You know what's funny? You'll like this. This is so funny. A fan of mine emailed me on through my website, to Facebook maybe, I think it was, and said that, oh my God, I just bought your first book on eBay. And I thought, oh, I'm so sorry. And she said, no, it was autographed by Gloria Jewell. You're kidding. How much did you pay for that? You paid $30.
That's a collector's item.
For a book autographed by my sister, and I thought, how odd. You know, what is that? And so I called Gloria and asked her, did you autograph one of my books in 1984? And she said, I don't remember, because what it said was, dear so-and-so, thank you for making my sister's Christmas a little extra special.
Oh.
Love, Gloria Jewel.
Look how we didn't even know that Gloria was doing a book tour at the time and just had stacks of your book and just signing them for people. Who knew? Who knew? I hear that she's going to be, you know, maybe Gloria's going to be in The Advocate wearing a veil.
Oh, I don't think so.
Okay.
Gloria's straight.
All right. Well, maybe we can get her with a veil in another publication or just to autograph the veil that you wore. That is so...
Make her look like Gloria Swanson.
I'm telling you. I'm never going to stop thinking about when he showed you the picture and you said, oh, okay. That is so funny. All right, so what do you have coming up? So you have Alcatraz coming up, and that's really exciting. What else is on the horizon?
Well, I've been booked on the road doing speaking and comedy, and who knows? You know, this industry is so... You never know
you never
what's going to be next.
And where can folks go to learn more about all the cool things that you're doing?
My website, www.jerryjewel.com, or Facebook, my fan page, because I am very active. I don't have somebody else working it. It is actually me.
It's you. It's you talking about Ann Coulter. It's not somebody else.
Oh, no. It was me.
So folks are going to have to check that out.
Yeah, I was kind of like, oh, do I even want to give her a mention? But she just, oh, I just cannot believe some of the things that come out of her mouth.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It provides endless fodder. She alone keeps this show Is So Gay going because it gives us stuff to talk about. I was laughing very hard when I saw that you wrote that. So folks are going to have to look you up on Facebook to see what that little kerfuffle is all about.
I do contribute to the blog, my blog, to the Huffington Post.
Great.
So I will always be writing blogs there. So that's another way they can keep in touch with me.
I have to tell you, Jerry Jewell, it is such, I mean, this show for years now, this show is about nothing if not about people using their voice. And the lesson that you provide to everyone, not just through the writing of the book, but just the totality of you, the lesson that you provide, the role modeling that you provide in look, whatever your voice is, use your voice because you have something to say is so unbelievably inspiring. I know that people have told you what a hero you are, but I hope it just gets through to you just what an incredible source of inspiration you provide just to the LGBT community, to all communities. It's just an honor to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you, Ken. And that means so much to me. I appreciate that.
So you're going to keep going because the pilot light is not going to go out. You're going to keep going. You're going to keep speaking and writing and putting your voice out there.
Absolutely.
Jerry Jewell, an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you for having me, Ken.
All the best, Jerry.
Happy, happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Just wow. Thank you for having me as a guest.
Oh, thanks, Jerry.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Folks, and we are back. Well, last week I read about an initiative to open a national LGBT museum in Washington, D.C., which I thought sounded amazing. And here to talk about that project is Tim Gold, the president of the board of directors of the Velvet Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit organization at the helm of those efforts. Tim Gold, welcome to this show, Is So Gay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So much to talk about with this museum, Tim. This sounds all very exciting. So you got to start us with the basics. Where did this initiative come from?
Well, I spent about 7 years working at the Smithsonian Institution, and what most people don't know is that James Smithson, the benefactor of the Smithsonian, was a gay man.
I did not know that.
Yes, and I don't know what, and I don't know what was more blasphemous, accusing of being British. He was a British scientist or being gay.
It's kind of it's a toss-up, Tim.
Yeah, he was both. He was a British scientist, never stepped foot in the United States, bequested his fortune to the U.S. government, and he was gay. He had no family to give his money to, so he decided to bequest it for nobody really knows the answer, but to the U.S. government to start a learning institution. But it didn't really fit into the image that the Smithsonian wants to project onto the American public. the visitors that come to D.C. And this isn't about bashing the Smithsonian. It's more about understanding that if a minority group wants their history to be told in a way that they want it to be told, they really have to take the responsibility to establish a museum or any sort of organization to get their message across. And we're seeing this more and more within museums, the African American Museum,
yep.
The Latino community is in discussions of having their own museum, and Native American Museum in D.C.
I just went to that one.
Yeah. So it's only natural that our community would get to a point when we would say to ourselves, listen, if we want our history to be told, we really need to be the ones to tell it.
All right. So you're sitting around with a bunch of people at a dinner party. This is how I imagine it to be, Tim. I don't know what the reality is. I mean, I have to say, I can plan an event, Tim, and I can host a radio show. I don't really know how to start a museum.
You know, this is a very good question. There was no kind of sitting around having drinks thinking, oh my gosh, we don't have a museum, we need to do this. It was kind of soul searching for me. When I learned that our history, and this was 2007, so this is a while back, and now we have, in San Francisco, we've got the GLBT Historical Society, that they have a museum, but at the time there was nothing.
Huh.
And I thought to myself, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we have such a rich history, and we need to do something about it, and having only 7 years of experience, I mean, being young, I think I know everything, but the truth is I didn't, and I still don't. So the first thing I did is recruit the smartest minds I could find within the institution, within the Smithsonian, that, you know, some of my mentors, and then just in the museum community to help me get this off the ground.
So now, would it be a subsidiary of the Smithsonian or a totally separate venture?
Totally separate.
Totally separate.
And when I tell people that, it's because, and I don't want to get into the whole, if your listeners want to Google the whole hide and seek exhibit that happened at the Smithsonian this past.
Oh, yes.
That big mess. We shouldn't have to worry about putting on an exhibit because we might lose federal funding.
Right.
We should be able to exhibit whatever we want to, and the only people that we should answer to is our own community.
Yeah. Now, why Washington, D.C.?
Because it's neutral.
Okay.
It's neutral. Last year we did a bunch of workshops, which was part of the first phase of our master planning process. And surprisingly, the LA folks, the San Francisco folks, the Florida folks, Chicago folks, New York, they all did agree that, you know, D.C. would be a neutral place. If we had it in New York, you know, the L.A. people are like, oh, why is it in New York? Why is it in L.A.?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the West Coast, East Coast battle. So it's neutral. It makes sense. It's the nation's capital. Second of all, the political statement that it makes to have a museum in Washington, D.C. It legitimizes our history. It says, you know, we're here, and we have a history, and it's at our nation's capital for everyone to view.
Well, and you said one of those key words, because the three words that I'm seeing all throughout this are the words, here I am. Where did that concept come from?
That came from a board member, Donna Redwing. She's amazing.
Yeah, of course.
You know Donna?
Yeah. Of course, yeah.
She has this wonderful speech. My husband, Mitchell Gold, I haven't heard it, but he says it's one of the best speeches ever. And it's about here I am. And she, before she joined the board, she was on. She was at one of the workshops, and she was kind of going over that whole theme. Here I am. You know, I have a history, and here I am. You know, you can't pigeonhole me. I'm an individual, but yet I'm a part of a larger group.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm reading through these notes in this workshop, and this theme, here I am, keeps coming back. And I just thought how powerful those words were, and how meaningful, and how it can relate to so many different people, gay, straight, bisexual, transgender. It doesn't matter who you are. It's like, here I am. I'm here to learn about my history. I'm here to learn about other people that I might not understand. And I hope to leave a better person.
And you mentioned Mitchell Gold, someone you perhaps know.
A little bit.
And he has a blog entry on the website. First of all, let me back up a step. I enjoy the website immensely. I know you're beta testing it and all that fun stuff. It's a pretty darn cool website.
Thank you. Yeah, this isn't going to be your typical museum. We want people to think outside the box. And so when I contacted this web developer, Xylem, out of Denver, I said, I want you to build something different where people have to think outside the box or come to the site and kind of set aside their preconceived notion of how things should be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's we do that all too often. We go to places and we say to ourselves, oh, this is how it should be. Why? Why should it be that way? The question I ask is, why should Washington, D.C. have tons of museums, a museum for beads, a museum for postage stamps, but no museum for the LGBT community?
Right.
Because it's just, that's the way it should be. So I asked them, and they gave it some thought, and they developed that, and again, for your viewers, I'd have to go to the website and kind of and see it, and I think I'm giving it away here. You don't scroll down the page. The pages sort of flip. And so they came back to me with that idea because people are used to, when they go to the website, scrolling down a page.
Right.
So instead of doing that, they have to kind of think for a second and be like, oh, wait a second, you don't really scroll. The pages sort of flip.
It took me a minute.
Yeah, that's the idea. I want people to stop and think and say, not get overly confused. You know, there's a fine line between frustrating the user and making them have that aha moment.
Right.
So I'm glad that you liked it. Yeah, it's an interesting idea to have the website sort of flip.
Yes.
Pages flip. Like
after a few minutes on Facebook adjusting to that, it took a couple seconds, I'm not going to lie. But it wasn't frustrating, so it's good. It's achieved its purpose.
Well, thank you.
Well, so Mitchell has a blog entry on there, and I wanted a quote from that, because I particularly like this sentence. He wrote, quote, "From the work I do, I know that equally as important is that the new museum will allow straight people to know that their children, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, friends, and anyone else they know, that they do not have to feel pity or shame or anything else other than gay is good and a natural part of a human's being." And I thought that was particularly salient because, I think there will be some people, not people that, you know, we talk to all the time, but some people who will assume, well, the audience for this is just gay people.
Yeah, isn't Mitchell great? it's not. I don't want your listeners to think this is a cop out because it's not, but what we envision is an American history museum told through the lens of the LGBT community.
Great.
We want anybody and everybody to walk through the door and be able to take something away. This isn't just for the LGBT community. It's for everybody. You know, you asked me why DC, and a third reason. And I try not to say this because I get choked up sometimes. But DC is one of the few cities where you get so many school groups, and it's one of the few cities where the school groups are, you know, at a certain age, especially high school, they're dropped off in the middle of the city, and the teacher's like, "Okay, go meet back at meet at Union Station at 5 p.m. Go explore." And so for a high school student struggling with his or her sexual identity, to be able to take a close friend and go to a museum like this and understand that, you know, that they're not alone is a powerful thing.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Absolutely.
And they're not doing that in New York. They're not dropping kids off.
No, not so much.
No.
My parents did, and look what happened. This is where we are now. Now, how can people get involved in this?
That's a good question. Well, on our website, you can sign up. It takes some... It's a national museum. It's gonna take all of us to give something. If it's just input, if it's their time, if it's money, however they can get involved, they can contact us through the website and we'll find a place. I mean, it's a national effort, and and you asked before, it's like, wow, it's like, how do you start a museum?
Yeah.
It's not easy. And even, you know, I've got the top museum professionals helping me with this. And it's hard for them because only a few people have an opportunity to establish something on a national scale.
Right.
In order to do that, it takes some trial and error, and it takes as many people as we can find to give us that input and feedback, and I mean, I hate to say it, but money too.
Oh yeah,
it takes a lot of money.
And this is perhaps the least nuanced question I've ever asked in the 3-year history of this show, but it's the one that just keeps coming to my mind. How is it going? What's the status right now of these efforts?
Thank you. Yeah, we're starting our second phase in January.
Okay.
The master planning process is 3 phases. The first phase is the envisioning phase, where we went out and asked, okay, what kind of museum do we want? And on the website, you'll see you probably saw it already, the conceptual phase plan and the core exhibits. And this is, nothing's written in stone. This will all change as the projects evolve. So that was the first stage. The second stage, which we're going to begin in January, early next year, is to kind of test it. Okay, so if we build this type of museum, you know, who's going to come?
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to get that wide demographic that we're trying to reach? Where should it be? Where in Washington, D.C. should it be? A question that I just really dying to get answered is, you know, are school groups ready for something like this? You know, and if we do have school groups, I mean, how does that affect what kind of exhibits we can do, and how do we have more provocative exhibits yet still allowing it to be friendly for school groups?
Right.
These are challenging questions, and they'll be answered in phase two. And then phase three is the always enjoyable capital campaign.
Oh yeah.
That's when we'll have the a location. We'll have the developers identify it, because we want it to be a multi-use space.
Right.
We want it to be a place where people can not just go to this museum, but go to the museum, then, you know, go shopping and go to dinner. It's a destination spot. Hopefully, where people can get the whole kind of experience and not just go to the museum and then leave.
So do you have a target date, or do we not even do? Does that jinx things? Do we not say that?
Well, I push for 5 years.
Nice.
At the board meetings, but it's all going to it's all about how many people we can get involved and how fast the community wants to see this museum, especially when we get to that third phase when it comes to the capital campaign, because it's no one wants to talk about it, but. Museums happen because either a community is behind it and wants it to happen, or some really, really rich person passes away and leaves all their money to somebody.
Right.
You'd be amazed how many museums are open because of that. That probably shouldn't be around.
Right.
But they are, just because somebody, you know, left a gazillion dollars to somebody, or to open a museum.
Not that you would turn that down.
Not that I would turn down. No, definitely not. No, definitely not. And we do have the support, and we're gaining more support, and it's become more public. I think people are really going to want to support an effort like this, because it brings the community together, and for a good reason, to celebrate our history and to learn and to move us forward.
Well, tell us real quick what makes for, because we have so many folks who write in, because we have a ton of nonprofit folks who work in nonprofit on the show that we love featuring. Tell us what makes for a successful board. It sounds like you have a very involved board of directors. What's working well there? What works for your board?
That is an excellent question. Patience.
Mm.
Patience. And a willing to understand that that it's not just about you.
Right.
It's about the community. This is a national, you know, project. And I have this conversation with Mitchell. You know, he started his business. If it failed, it was, it was his business partner, and that was it.
Right.
But we have a lot of weight on our shoulders. We're responsible for creating a national museum for the entire community. And that takes a lot of patience, and it takes setting aside your ego and understanding that you're not working. It's not just the board. We're working for the community and for for the, especially the people that can't speak for themselves. And,
yeah.
And it's hard. I mean, how do you put that all in a museum?
Right. No pressure.
Yeah, well, and I know we can do it, and I'm confident we can do it, and we're moving. I think we're moving in that right direction, but you know, it's finding people that are not just committed and passionate. I find people like that every day.
Right.
But it's people that realize that this project is more than just the board. It's more than just me. It's more than them. It's about the entire community. It's about the nation.
Now, we should acknowledge that the expectations for the furniture featured in the museum are quite high, just by association. I mean, there's really no pressure there, but let's just put that out there.
He's still in his company. They've been very supportive. And, you know, it's easy for people to say, oh, yeah, of course, it's your husband. He's got to be supportive.
no, he doesn't.
You know, you're right. He does. He does. But if anybody that knows my husband, Mitchell, he is the most generous person. And he and Bob and the company, they get involved with so many organizations, and they're so generous with their time and their money and donating furniture. So I hope, yeah. So
I hope this interview cements that for you. We can just play this on a loop there in one of the flagship stores.
Yeah, I love my husband. Mitchell's a great guy.
And we should say it sounds like there was a holiday celebration recently.
Yeah, Betty, the New York band Betty. I don't know if.
Oh yeah, we're gonna, and actually, I was gonna tell you in honor of that, we're gonna play some Betty on this week's show.
We love Betty. They're so great. They came down to D.C. and we had a great time, a great holiday party. We raised some money for the foundation, and we just all had a wonderful time.
Oh, this is very exciting. Now, you, of course, will come back on the show and give us updates on this.
I would love to.
Because we want to keep tabs on this, some sort of progress bar on our website. Probably not, but we might do it.
I have that idea.
Oh, yeah. Look at that. So we want to know how this is going, because this is – I was just in D.C. 3 weeks ago and walked around to the different museums, and actually had this moment where I was – I might edit this story out later. We'll see. That I was kind of desperate for some gay content as I was walking around to the different museums. And I went to the American History Museum, and I figured I'll go see the First Lady's exhibit of the dresses, but that was closed. And then I wanted to go to the Phyllis Diller exhibit, but that was closed. I was desperate for any type of gay association. And so I would have liked to have gone to the National LGBT Museum.
Someday soon.
You are doing good work there, Tim Gold, and you're going to keep us posted, and we love supporting you in these efforts. This is really, I mean, the story you told just about what will happen of two students going there. I mean, that's not a pipe dream story. That's something that will inevitably happen, and not to mention just all the allies that will go there and then go back home and end up being even more supportive allies. It will make a huge difference.
Well, thank you.
All right. All the best, Tim, and keep us posted.
Okay, I will.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Bye. Folks, that wraps things up for another week's episode of This Show Is So Gay. As always, write to us. Send us an email. Send it to Ken at thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to see our upcoming guests. We have incredible, incredible upcoming guests. And go to that Facebook thing. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. Get out there, folks. Use your voice. Start a museum. Do a comedy routine. Do whatever it is that you do to make a difference in this world. And while you're doing it, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Do not feel like this anymore, but somebody found